Chapter 52. A crowd of nearly 1,000 people stood outside the residence of the Prime Minister, applauding and waving placards and hand-painted banners in French and English, wishing Charles Sarveau well as he arrived home from the hospital. The doctors had insisted that he be transported by ambulance, but he firmly ignored their advice and rode home in the official limousine, impeccably dressed in a newly purchased suit, his scarred hands concealed by a pair of oversized kid gloves. One of his party advisers suggested he keep his bandages in plain view to evoke public sentiment. But Sarveau would have no part of gimmicky politics. It was not his way. The pain in his hip was excruciating. His arms were stiff with scar tissue and exploded in agony every time he attempted to move them. He was thankful the crowds and reporters were too distant to see the sweat that ran down his face as he smiled through tight lips and waved to their cheers. The car passed through the gate and stopped at the front steps. Daniel rushed up to the door and threw it open.
"Welcome home, Charles."
The words stuck in her throat when she saw the tortured face, deep-etched in ashen suffering.
"Help me inside," he whispered.
"Let me get a Mountie."
"No," he cut her off. "I will not be taken for an invalid."
He twisted in the back seat and placed his feet on the ground, his body half in, half out of the car. He took a moment to steel himself against the torment, then hooked one arm around Danielle's waist and swayed to a standing position. She nearly went down under his weight. It took all her strength to hold him upright. She could almost feel the agony emanate from him as they shuffled up the steps of the landing. At the doorway, he turned and flashed the famous Charles Sarveau smile at a bevy of reporters across the drive and made a thumbs-up sign. Once the front door closed, his iron will gave out and he began to sink to the carpet. A Mountie swiftly pushed Danielle aside and grabbed him around the shoulders. A doctor and two nurses materialized, and together they gently carried him up the stairs to his room. "You were mad to play hero," the doctor reprimanded Sarveau after settling the Prime Minister in bed. "Your fracture is far from fully healed. You might have caused serious damage and set back your recovery." "A small risk to assure the people that their leader is not a vegetable," Sarveau smiled weakly. Danielle came and sat on the edge of the bed.
"You've made your point, Charles. There is no need to exert yourself."
He kissed her hand. "I beg your forgiveness, Danielle." She looked at him in confusion.
"Forgiveness?"
"Yes," he said softly so the others in the room did not hear. "I undervalued your spirit. I always looked upon you as a wealthy child whose only aim in life was to nurture a great beauty and indulge in Cinderella fantasies. I was wrong."
"I'm not sure I understand," she said hesitantly.
"In my absence, you stepped into my shoes and took up the reins of office with dignity and determination," he said sincerely. "You have truly proven that Danielle Sarveau is the first lady of the land." Suddenly, she felt a deep sadness for him. In certain respects, he was perceptive, and in others, he seemed naive. Only now was he beginning to appreciate her capabilities. And yet, her desires completely eluded him. He could not see that she was an illusion, could not guess the extent of her deceit. By the time he came to know her fully, she thought, it would be too late. Sarveau was in his robe, seated on the sofa and staring at the television set, when Henri Villon entered his room later that night. A news commentator was standing in the middle of Quebec Street, surrounded by a huge crowd of cheering people. "Thank you for coming, Henri." Villon looked at the TV. "It's done," he said quietly. "The referendum for full independence has passed. Quebec is a nation." "Now the chaos begins," said Sarveau. He punched the off button on the control box and the TV set went dark. Then he turned to Villon and motioned to a chair. "How do you see it?"
"I'm certain the transition will be smooth."
"You're overly optimistic. Until a general election can be held to install a new government, Quebec's parliament will be in turmoil. A golden opportunity for the FQS to rise up out of their sewer and make a power play. He shook his head sadly. Jules Guerrier's death could not have come at a worse time. He and I could have worked together in softening the road. Now I don't know. Surely you feel that the vacuum left by Jules can be filled?
By whom?
You, perhaps? A hardness came into Villon's eyes. No man is better qualified. My efforts were instrumental in putting across the referendum. I have the backing of the trade unions and financial institutions. I am a respected party leader, and most important, I am a Frenchman who is highly regarded by the rest of Canada. Quebec needs me, Charles. I shall run for president, and I'll win. So, Henri Villon is going to lead Quebec out of the wilderness, said Servais caustically. French culture is more alive today than ever before. My sacred duty is to nourish it. Stop waving the fleur-de-lis, Henri. It doesn't become you. I have deep feelings for my native land. You have deep feelings for only Henri Villon. You think so little of me, snapped Villon. Servais stared him in the eye. I had a high opinion of you once, but I watched as blind ambition transformed a dedicated idealist into a devious schemer. Villon glared back. I think you should explain yourself. For starters, what possessed you to black out a third of the United States at the James Bay Power Project? Villon's expression turned impassive. I felt it was necessary. The blackout was meant as a warning to the Americans to keep their hands off of French affairs. Where did you get such an insane idea? Villon gave him a bemused look. From you, of course. Servais' expression went blank. Suddenly, Villon began to laugh. You really don't remember, do you?
Remember what? Servais asked mechanically.
In the hospital after the plane crash, your mind was confused from the anesthetic. You raved about Canada being in great peril if the wrong people discovered the vulnerability of the control booth at James Bay. You were vague on the meaning. But then you instructed Daniel to tell me to consult Max Roubaix, the long-dead Garotte murderer. Servais sat mute, his face unreadable. A damned clever riddle, considering it came from a scrambled brain, Villon continued. It took me a while to figure the parallel between Roubaix's favorite weapon and an energy stranglehold. I thank you for that, Charles. You unwittingly showed me how to make the Americans dance to the mere flip of an electrical switch. Servais sat in silence for a moment, then he looked up at Villon and said, Not unwittingly. Villon missed the point.
Pardon.
Daniel did not hear the raving of a delirious man. There was a great deal of pain, but my mind was clear when I told her I wanted you to consult Max Roubaix.
Playing some sort of childish game, Charles?
Servais ignored him. A very old and dear friend said you would betray my trust and the faith the Canadian people had in you. I could not bring myself to believe you were a traitor, Henri, but I had to be sure. You took the bait and threatened the United States with energy blackmail. A grave mistake on your part, antagonizing a superpower in the next yard. Villon's mouth tightened in an ugly grin.
So you think you know something. To hell with you and to hell with the United States.
As long as Quebec controls the St. Lawrence River and the hydroelectricity from James Bay, it will be we who dictate to them and Western Canada for a change. The Americans' righteous and holy preaching has made them clowns in the eyes of the world. They sit smug in their stupid morality, caring only about their private assets and bank accounts. America is a fading power on the way out. Inflation will finish their economic system. If they dare try and ram sanctions down Quebec's throat, we'll cut their circuits.
Brave talk, said Servais. But like so many others, you'll find that underestimating their resolve never pays. When their backs are to the wall, the Americans have a habit of coming out fighting.
The guts have gone out of them, Villon sneered.
You're a fool.
Servais could not suppress the chill that ran through him. For the good of Canada, I will unmask and break you.
You couldn't break a shop clerk, Vion mocked him. You haven't got a shred of solid evidence against me. No, Charles. Soon the English-speaking bastards will kick you out of office, and I'll see to it you're not welcome in Quebec. It's about time you woke up to the fact that you're a man without a country. Vion rose and pulled a sealed envelope from his breast pocket and dropped it rudely in Sarva's lap. My resignation from the cabinet. Accepted, Sarva said with grim finality. Vion could not leave without one parting insult. You're a pitiful creature, Charles. You haven't come to grips with it yet, but you have nothing left, not even your precious Danielle. At the doorway, Vion turned for a last look at Sarva, expecting to see a man drowning in despair and defeat, his hopes and dreams shattered beyond repair. Instead, he saw a man who was inexplicably smiling. Vion went direct to his office in the Parliament building and began cleaning out his desk. He saw no purpose in waiting for morning and suffering through a multitude of goodbyes from men he neither respected nor liked. His chief aide knocked and entered. You have several messages. Vion waved a hand and cut him off. I'm not interested. As of 1 hour ago, I am no longer Minister of Internal Affairs. There is one from Mr. Brian Shaw that sounded quite urgent. Also, General Sims has been personally trying to reach you. Yes, that North American treaty affair, Vion said without looking up. They're probably begging for more men and equipment. Actually, it's a request for our Navy to escort the American ship off the wreckage of the Empress of Ireland. Fill out the necessary papers and sign my name to them. Then contact the commanding naval officer of the St. Lawrence District and have him carry out the request. The aide turned and started for his office. Wait! Vion's French fervor suddenly welled up within him. One more thing. Instruct General Sims and Mr. Shaw that the sovereign nation of Quebec no longer relishes British meddling in her territory, and they are to cease all surveillance activities at once. Then get a message to our mercenary friend, Mr. Gly. Tell him there's a fat bonus for giving the Numa ship a rousing farewell party. He'll understand.